Jesus says to love God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. In other words, love God with all that you are and with all that you have, and above everything and everyone else. This is unquestionable. This is clear teaching of the Bible. It's consistent. It began before Jesus uttered the words. God said, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Do not make for yourself any graven images." Over and over, the Bible teaches us with great and specific clarity that faith is to be focused on God alone. Not other gods, not anything else, not anything that we make, create, or establish. Only on God. Love for God with everything that you are, with all that you have, and with everything that you can bring to that experience, love for God is what keeps us from loving other things more than God. Love for God is the solution to idolatry. Love for God is the solution to sinfulness and rebellion. Love for God is the only hope that we have in a world that beckons always and continually love yourself. You say, well, if I don't do what I need to take care of myself, then how am I going to love God? I didn't say anything about taking care of yourself. Of course you're supposed to take care of yourself. I said don't love yourself. Well, what's the difference? There's a huge difference. I promise you this, that if you will, even if you don't understand what I'm saying, if you will love God at the expense and the exclusion of all else as supreme and as Lord of all, you will never lack for care for yourself. No one else that you love will lack for the genuineness, the fulfillment, and the supply of your love. If you love God, everything else that you love will find its appropriate perspective and place and will not suffer in any measure unless it really needs to. So what does this mean? It means that He has called us to have the kind of faith that is focused on Him, not idols. Focused on Him, not circumstances. Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3, a very familiar story, begins by reminding us of the dangers of the gods that we construct. It says in verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, whose breadth was 6 cubits, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Why does he repeat this over and over? He wants us to understand that the very source of leadership that existed in the known world and in the highest and strongest government that existed in that world and was being guided by a single person, Nebuchadnezzar, that they have assumed a role that belongs only to God and have established themselves as God and have gathered together to dedicate themselves to their self-made gods. That's what he was doing. Now, the repetition bothers me. I don't like reading governors and satraps and prefects and so forth over and over. I also don't like reading the list of instruments that are going to be played at this dedication in just a moment over and over. But there is a method behind it. He is driving home the point of the dangers of these gods that we construct. So Nebuchadnezzar builds an image. I don't know what the image looks like. It doesn't necessarily track that it looked like him, although it could have had his head on it. It is made out of all gold. Now that doesn't mean it was solid gold. It means it's overlaid with gold. And the gold would have made it stand out among all of these other things. But keep in mind, that the description that is given here tells us that it was 90 feet tall and that it was 6 feet thick. So this is a big image. Archaeologists have uncovered what they believe to be the base of this image. So that 90 feet probably didn't consist of the entire image was 90 feet tall, because it's not likely that, given these dimensions, that it could have stood. It would have been on a base that elevated out of the plain and probably worked its way up in a pyramidal type form. But if that is true, this base that they have found out in the middle of the plain of Dura in Babylon could very well be some affirmation of this biblical description that we have here. The image was established as all gold, overlaid with all gold. Sound familiar? We just read and studied about the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, that Daniel interpreted for him, of the image that he saw. The head was made of gold, and the head, he said, represented Nebuchadnezzar. But then you see different materials that flowed down through that image. And now what he is doing is he's taken that golden head that he wants to continue forevermore, and he's made the entire image of that as a means of displaying his own glory and overcoming what he at the time had accepted as the true word of God. Is that exactly what he meant? I don't know. That's my interpretation. It doesn't actually say that here or anywhere else, but it does seem to track. So now he gathers everybody together to make sure that they understand that this is God. I think it is likely that the image that he set up in front of them wasn't an image of his own. It wasn't something that was picturing him. It was probably something that was picturing the prominent or most prominent God that existed in Babylon, and he was trying to assert authority of this God over all of the other gods, including the God of the Israelites. And so he is saying, look, this is the approved God. You can worship other gods if you want to, but you absolutely must worship this one as preeminent. And so he's bringing them all together. If all of the leadership understands the requirements, then they will be able to disseminate that to all of the people in the provinces where they have been given authority. And so he is reminding them that this is, in fact, what you're going to worship. The dangers of the gods that we construct is that, number one, they're made in our image. Number two, they are made out of earthly materials. Three, they aren't gods at all. They're just dead stone and metal. Do we construct gods today still? Well, no, we're Christians. We live in a largely Christian environment, and we worship Christ, and we serve only the living God. And yet, with our words, we express these kinds of things, but in fact, how much gold have we collected, and how are we putting it on display, and how are we showing our own prowess and our own ability? How are we strutting our own authority, and how are we trying to manipulate and control those around us? Over and over again, we are reminded of our own idolatry. I'm not sad that we are idol worshipers. I am sad that we are ignorant of the truth. I'm not upset that we have built these gods that are false and that are made in our own image and serve only our own desire and well-being. I'm not angry about that. I'm angry that we do that without an awareness of its destructiveness and of our own culpability in it. The dangers of the gods we construct is that we have approved them, and we've gathered people together who join with us in that approval, so that it becomes common and no longer challenged by the truth. Nebuchadnezzar took the wealth of his kingdom. He took the ability of his kingdom. He took the manpower of his kingdom, and he focused it on constructing a false god that ultimately would not bring power to that God, but would ultimately lend power to him. That was the whole point. It was a specific design to make him more powerful. The gods that we construct are the same gods that we use in order to build up ourselves, to make ourselves feel powerful, to give ourselves a sense of well-being or accomplishment or whatever it is. And we find that satisfaction outside of our service to God. We find that satisfaction outside or beyond our worship of God. And so by compartmentalizing such things, we are in fact becoming idol worshipers in the same manner that he was. The demands of the gods that we accept as common then represent a great threat. In verse 4 it says, the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, and when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down, and they worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Is that still the case today? Part of the demands of the gods that we accept as common are that we go along with the crowd, that we fit in, that we be popular. We even hear the same mantra being declared inside the church, that the church needs to not be so rigid. We shouldn't be so stuck on this truth. We shouldn't be so obedient to biblical teaching because it may not even be real. And over again, we hear all of these denials that are designed specifically not to make us better, but to make us more like the majority. You say, well, I want to fit in. I mean, doesn't that help our witness? Does it? Isn't it possible that you can witness, remain true, and not be a pariah? And even if you're rejected, I mean, as long as you're being rejected not for being ungodly or unchristlike, isn't it more important that we be true, that we be consistent, that we be faithful? The dangers of the gods that we construct are that they are of our own making and they are also of our own control. The demands of those gods, though once established, is that we become like everything else around us rather than like the one who has made us and called us. Everything that Christ does in the life of the believer through the sanctifying work and application of the Spirit's presence is to transform us so that we become more like Him. But everything that the world around us is doing is to keep us so that we remain like it. If you are more like the world that you live in than you are like Christ who has redeemed you out of that, or if you are driven more by the standards of the world around you than you are by Christ within you, then you need to assess and take account of the demands of your gods. Just because they're common doesn't mean they're right. So they all fell down and they worshiped. But in verse 8, therefore, at that time, the Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you set up." I really don't like the Chaldeans. One, they're so whiny and spineless in their methodology that it's insulting. It makes me want to punch them in the side of the head just for opening their mouths. It's just infuriating. It's so sniveling. It's so conniving. It is so undermining. If you've got a problem with the Israelites, why don't you go talk to them? No, let's go talk to the king. Let's go remind the king. Let's go coddle up to the king. And so that's what they do. Sycophants, that's what they are. And it's just disgusting. But nonetheless, you recognize it for what it is. So the Chaldeans come forward, they accuse them. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were standing in the back. Apparently Nebuchadnezzar couldn't see them, and they did not bow down. But the Chaldeans did see them. And so they said, you said that if they don't do it, they're going to be thrown into the furnace. Now, have you ever wondered, there's a lot about the image that's set up. Nothing is said about the furnace. How do you get a furnace in there? Where did that come from? Well, how do you think they melted the gold? They built a furnace, and it would have been like what you see with these things you put on your porch and you burn wood in. It's made out of clay, and it's got a kind of a big round bottom to it, and then it comes up with a chimney top, and then it has an opening on the side where you can feed the wood into it. It would have been something similar to that, but on a much larger scale. And so they would have fired this thing from below so that they would be able to see into the fire, but they had to have constructed some sort of ladder or some sort of stairway to go up to the top of it, where they were going to use that they had previously used to melt the gold and to process all of that stuff and probably fire the bricks that they had made the image out of. And they were going to use that then now as a device of punishment. So it had already been there for a long time. Now they're going to use it for a threat. And so they said, look, if you don't do what you're told, you're going to go into the fire. Well, you know, there it'd been there a long time, burning and smelting metal and firing bricks. And so they were well familiar with the capability of this furnace. So Nebuchadnezzar responds. It says, then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. He answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, then well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands then? You see, the demands of the gods that we accept as common eventually come back to bite us. And that's what's happening here. These gods are demanding allegiance. Anything that you replace the worship of the living God with will ultimately, at some point or another, demand your allegiance. It will demand your subservience. It will demand that you surrender your freedom. Have you ever thought how ironic it is that we declare ourselves free so that we choose these other gods, but in the process of doing that, what do we do? We end up serving them, and we are controlled by them. And we are in obedience and bondage to them. It is a remarkable thing when we see the demands of the gods that we have accepted as common, and we see the threat that they are imposing upon us. And so Nebuchadnezzar brings them back, and he says, look, I like you guys. I'm pretty upset with you right now, but I like you guys. I'm going to give you another chance. And he goes back through it one more time. I'm going to give you an opportunity to do the right thing, to save yourselves. The demands of the gods that we accept as common demand that we surrender not only our freedom, but our faithfulness to serve another person, rather than to serve the God of all persons. The gods that we accept as common and the idols that we have created on our own will at some time or another demand that we choose between what is true and what is false. Are you going to serve God? Or will you serve this? What did Jesus have to say about it? He said this: you cannot serve God and money. Because he said, you're going to love one and hate the other, or you're going to love the other and hate the one. But you can't have two masters. And so he reminds us that there can only be one Lord. But then he also demonstrates to us that serving God doesn't mean there won't be a requirement of sacrifice. The difference is sacrifice is something that we give willingly and without coercion as an expression of love and worship. What Nebuchadnezzar wanted was surrender that was demanded upon threat and penalty of death. So, are the gods that we establish and the gods that we build and the gods that we have accepted as common, are they building us up? Are they calling us to a higher standard of love and self-sacrifice? Are they demonstrating for us that sacrifice, having led the way as Jesus did? Or are they threatening us? And are they trying to control us and trying to force us into some sort of limited understanding and some sort of slave-type bondage? You already know the answer. The answer is obvious. What isn't obvious is that we have so many idols among us. Nebuchadnezzar, he's wired pretty tight right now, and he's pretty upset. And I could go into what's going to happen next, but if I do that, I don't have enough time to finish it now. I was going to do that to begin with. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to split it right here. If you want to know what happens to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you'll have to come back next week. Because there isn't any way for you to know unless I tell you, right? Yes, you can read it for yourself, but let's just be honest. It's not going to be the same. So we'll come back to it, and we'll finish it up next week. Here's the thing. The Bible teaches us that our faith is to be focused on God and certainly not on our circumstances. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to show us what that looks like in a very real way that is going to enable something we talked about earlier on: endurance and faithfulness in spite of circumstances. I don't know what your circumstances are right now. I mean, some of you I do, but not all of you. But I know this. I know that God is able to sustain you in them and to guide you through them. And before you walk out of the room, I want you to look around and reflect on the lives that you have shared with people that are part of this church. And remember some of the things that you've gone through together, either your own challenges or theirs. And remember how God has sustained you all. And the evidence of that is the fact that you're all still here and still serving God. Yes, it's tough right now. But that's just right now. It's going to change. God's still in charge. Focus your attention on Him, not on the circumstances that are trying to pull you away from Him.